Welcome to the last talk in the room Enum for the TDF this year. We have the talk Stars at Your Fingertips from Wilhelmina, and enjoy the talk.
Thank you very much. Hello, as you just said, I'm Wilhelmina. I just finished my PhD in astrophysics, and right now I'm doing nothing, but yeah, I want to tell you people about what I've learned. And what my biggest takeaway actually from this project is that if you like computers even a little bit, and if you're comfortable with solving problems, then astrophysics is for you too. Okay, so let's start. Oh, I don't even know if you can see this very clearly, but if you look up at the night sky on a fairly good day, you probably see something like this. Right, just a handful of stars, a lot of light pollution, but that's about it. But every time astrophysics turns up in the news, you see something like this, right? Or you probably encounter headlines like this. And you might think, okay, wow, that's really cool, but it might all seem a bit far away from you, like somebody somewhere with some very expensive equipment is doing all of this, probably, right? They probably use something like this, and they probably look like this guy, right? And what I want to convince you of in this talk today is that is really not the case. The universe is yours too, and I want to tell you right now that the data from the largest missions humanity has ever put out, the biggest telescopes, are all available for free online. And all the tools to analyze them, the biggest ones, the most useful ones, these are all open source and free to use too. And you might think, okay, but I probably need to study 10 years for this. And I want to convince you that that's not the case either. The barrier to entry is much smaller than you think. Okay, so let's get started. What information do you actually get from space on Earth? It's light. It's mostly light. There's other stuff too, but it's mostly light. And light comes in different colors, and we only see a small fraction of it. This is called visible light. You see the colors between blue to red. But then there's a vast amount of light, many different colors of light that are just completely invisible to the human eye. But these colors are not invisible to cameras, to detectors. And if you can see things in different colors of light, then you can see completely different things too. One very simple example is a thermal camera. A thermal camera looks at infrared light. It's a type of light that human eyes can't see. And when you look at a person in infrared light, you can see how warm their body is. So with infrared light, you can see something you couldn't otherwise see with normal visible light. And the same goes for space too. When we look up at space, we use cameras that see things in different types of light. Sometimes we look at objects in visible light, the light we can see, but many times we look at objects in lights, in colors that we cannot see. But you might be looking at this and thinking, okay, I get that, but then I can literally see this. I mean, it's purple and yellow. And this is basically just a trick we do. It's color mapping. So let's say you have your infrared light in this portion of light which you just can't see. We just say, okay, if we could see it, we would map these colors onto this segment of light to say, okay, if we could see this light, we would see something like the picture I just showed you. Okay, so most of the information we get from space is in the form of light. So let's put it more concretely. What type of data do you actually get from space? If your object in space is big enough and it's bright enough, you can simply take an image. And you can take an image of your object in different colors of light. So this, for example, is a picture of the sun, the exact same sun taken at the exact same time, but with two different cameras. On the left, we have a camera taking an image in normal visible light, and you probably see some spots. But on the right, you have cameras that can see in UV light, which is a type of color our eyes cannot see. So you can see the crazy difference between these two images. It's the same object, but then different colors of light reveal completely different features that are otherwise invisible. Okay, so images are one type of data. But quite often, there are a lot of things in space that are simply too far away, and too relatively small for us to take pictures of. For example, stars. Even with our best telescopes, for the most part, stars appear as tiny bright points. And when you have tiny bright points, you can't take pictures of it. You can't really see features like this. So we need to use other tools to figure out what's going on in a star. So there are two other data types that astronomers typically use. One are called light curves, which is basically a measurement of the brightness of the star taken over time. So you look at this tiny bright point and you say, okay, at this time it's this bright, it's this bright, it's this bright. And you might notice suddenly, okay, wait, it's getting dim, it's getting dim, it's getting dim. And then again, it's bright again, it's bright again, it's bright again. And all this without seeing the star. But then this already is a lot of information. In the example I just gave you, I'm talking about a planet transit. What is happening is you have a star and you have a planet orbiting it. And whenever the planet comes in between you and the star, it blocks out some light and makes the light of the star look dimmer. And when the planet goes away, the star gets brighter again. And by simply looking at the light curve of the star, you can say, hey, I think I found a planet. So that's one piece of information. The second are spectra. When you have some light and you pass it through a prism, the prism splits up the light into different colors. More technically speaking, a spectra is simply a plot of the brightness versus the color of any given object. It basically tells you which color is the brightest for some object. So in this example, if you look at a very hot blue flame, you can see that blue is the brightest color. And there are some other colors in this picture, but then they are less and less bright. They're more and more faint. So the spectra of this flame has that particular shape. And in the case of a flame that's less hot, that appears more orange, you can see that orange is the brightest color, and the other colors are less and less bright. So the orange flame has this shape. Now imagine you only had the spectra. You didn't know that the flames actually look from this. If you looked at the spectra, you might be able to say, by looking at the spectra alone, I can guess that this flame is mostly blue looking, or this flame is mostly orange looking. The same thing applies to stars. You can say that this star is mostly blue, this star is mostly orange, and therefore you can say this star, blue means hotter, so this star is probably hotter and this star is probably cooler. Okay, so I've told you about the three biggest forms of astronomical data. How is this data actually stored? Astrophysical data is stored in something that's known as a FITS file. A FITS file is simply a collection of data plus what is known as a header. A header is simply metadata, data about the data. So for example, if your data is a light curve, you will simply have something that looks like an Excel sheet, basically, of two columns, brightness and time, the brightness of your star at this time. Okay? And then the header will tell you when was this data taken, what type of data is it, which telescope took it. The header stores important information about your data itself. And that is all there is to a FITS file. Sometimes for more complicated FITS file, you have several data and headers packaged together, but this is the basic unit of a FITS file. Okay, so how do you open and work with a FITS file? Two of the main tools us astronomers use are TopCat, which is a GUI. You can simply open and manipulate these FITS files the way you would with any Excel sheet. It's just you load a table, you can plot it, you can play around with the data. Or you could use a Python package known as AstroPy. There are many Python packages, but this is the biggest one. And I've put some code cells over here just to illustrate how easy it is to actually work with the FITS file. The first two lines is to open the FITS file. The second line is just to, the second cell just shows you how to look at it. Good, now you see a table. And the third cell just shows you four lines of code that tells you how to plot the data. And look, you found a transit. This is a light curve, and the dips that you see are basically from a planet that's crossing a star far, far away. And in just a few lines of code, you found a planet. You might think, okay, all of this is great, but like, where do I even start? You know, astronomy is a huge field. One place that I would suggest you start is the site called Zooniverse. Now, Zooniverse is a website that hosts citizen science projects. These are basically scientific projects that scientists need some collaboration of the public with. So, for example, on the left, you have one project called Galaxy Zoo. So scientists have thousands upon thousands of images, usually blurry images, of galaxies, which are basically units containing millions and millions of stars that are crashing into each other. And they need to look at each of these images, and actually these are the best ones of the lot, and try to figure out, in this image, am I actually seeing two galaxies crashing into each other or not? So if you were to take part in this, you would click through these images and say, I think I see two galaxies crashing together. I think there are only two in this image, maybe not three. Or you would say, OK, this is too blurry. I can't make out. And you help scientists do actual science. And another project, for example, is called Planet Hunter's Tess. You have transit data in the form of a light curve, what I've been telling you about so far. And you need to pick out where you see these deep dips. And you mark all of them, and you say, see, I found all of these deep dips. And then you can, these are sent to the PI, the scientist in charge of the project, who then can say, OK, I think we found a planet over here, a brand new planet that no one has ever found. Now, why am I pointing you to Zooniverse? Zooniverse basically has the nicest, cleanest form of data possible. OK, these images are nicely clean, nicely formatted, and given to you with a very simple science case, usually. For the project on the right, you need to find planets. For the project on the left, you need to see whether you see galaxies crashing into each other. But you, a lot of you, I think, have some interest in programming. And you might think, surely there's a better way to do this than by eye. And if you can think of a better way, this is a great place to start. Because the data itself is all hosted online. You can start here, look at the science case, and think, can I do one better? Can I contribute somehow other than simply picking things by eye? And I would encourage you to do so too. One database, a useful database I would like to point you to is called Aladdin. It's just a database. It's not completely complete, but it's a large database of various astronomical sources, their positions, and all the published papers related to these astronomical sources. If you simply feel like exploring, you know, you don't have any intention in mind, but you would just like to explore all the data that's out there, I would greatly recommend something called ESASky. It's basically the Google Maps of the sky. Okay, you can simply scroll through images of the sky, data from various different telescopes, and just see, just take a look. And this is important because there is just so much data that chances are you're probably the first person to see it. Like only a month ago, a colleague of mine was doing this, and you think, hey, I think I found something weird. And this was simply by looking. He hadn't even gotten to the coding part yet. He was just looking at the same objects in different colors of light, and he found something. And this is one example that I really like. It's of what's called the Crab Nebula. If you look at it in X-rays, which is a color of light that your eyes can't see, you will see something like this. You'll see this little dot in the middle, which is basically a neutron star, that's shooting out jets and has these rings, these disks around it. But if you look at the same image in another type of light, invisible light, the kind of light that your eyes can see, you will see something else entirely, something like this. And this in itself is something astounding. So I would greatly encourage you all to go and take a look at ESASky. Now I'm going to point you to two incredible open source projects that I find very interesting. One is by a person named Judy Smith. Now, Judy Smith is not an astronomer. She's professionally a graphic designer based in California. But what she does is take unprocessed James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, data and makes and processes them to bring out important and beautiful astronomical features. So in this example over here, this is one of her tweets. She's basically the first person to lay eyes on something like this, like these incredible rings that are forming around a star. Not even the scientists who worked on this probably saw this. Let me illustrate what I mean. When you have raw data of something, this is a James Webb, this is raw data of a galaxy, the Phantom Galaxy, from the James Webb Space Telescope. It's unprocessed. And it's not trivial to process it either. You would have to be very careful about what kind of light you want to enhance, what you want to subtract, to make sure that the right features pop out so that you can then look into it deeper. And this is what Judy Schmidt did with this image. And this is not manipulation, this is enhancing specific features so that you can start asking questions. Like one question that might come to you immediately is, what is the structure actually? Why are there so many holes in between? That is a valid question to ask, and that's a question you can ask only if you know how to process the data. And she's basically used open source tools, and her workflow is completely online, by the way, plus Photoshop, essentially. And a lot of her images have been used officially as well by NASA and ESA, and when the scientists finally do get to it. Another thing I'd like to tell you about is SETI, which you might have heard of. It's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's from the 50s, where basically astronomers pointed radio telescopes at the sky and tried to search for intelligent life in space, basically aliens. The idea is if they get some kind of radio signal that's very sharp, very distinct, something that they haven't seen in any other kind of radio signal you see on Earth or you normally see from space, it might just come from aliens. So there's a huge volume of data that has been gathered. And between 1999 and 2020, some of this was outsourced to millions of people around the world who lend some of their processing power to kind of process each of these little chunks of radio data. So now there was this large, large database of radio data. And now there's a project by the same people called Breakthrough Listen, where they've put all of this data online, as well as the tools to analyze this data online for anybody to try and find signals that might come from intelligent aliens. And with that, I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for that cool talk. I think now the Tage der digitalen Freiheit over, so you have time to help the scientific community to explore new planets. So I think you saw how to do that, and yeah. Are there questions?
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you for your talk. It was the most interesting so far.
Thank you.
Maybe that's because I'm a physicist. my question is, do you think alien civilizations would be interested in talking with us?
I don't know. There's a very famous paradox called the Fermi paradox, which says, okay, if the universe is so huge and there are actually so many aliens out there, how come we haven't heard of anything from them? And the answer is, I don't know. I think my guess is that we're just alive for such a tiny fraction of time. Like humans have been around for such a tiny fraction of time, and we've had the technology we have today also for such a tiny fraction of time in terms of cosmic scale, that we just don't have enough data to say so, but it's possible.
The next SETI question. So how far away would we be heard or seen with the emissions that we create on Earth if there's just our physics and nothing fancy other stuff that we don't know of?
How far away?
Yeah. Given we produce radio signals since I don't know when.
Yeah, so
it's 100 light years away.
Yeah, right.
Okay. The limit is the speed of light, right? Radio is light. Radio waves are light. So nothing can transfer faster than light, right? So if an alien civilization is like 1,000 light years away, well, we haven't been around for 1,000 years to actually see what would happen. So that's already a limit.
Hi, thanks for the talk. So you mentioned that there are several kinds of light that you can get from your telescopes and your images and your data. is there some more useful light than other? Like, is ultraviolet, for instance, more useful than visible light or infrared?
I don't know. I don't think there's any such thing as useful or not useful. There's only what can we do and not do with something. Okay, for example, I've been talking about colors of light, but actually it's not quite right. I should have said wavelengths, but I didn't want to make this topic very very specific. So if you go to higher and higher energies or smaller and smaller wavelengths, say X-rays, these are very energetic, and they're also very rare. Right? When we look at X-rays, we're actually looking at individual photons, and we get like a handful of photons. So already at the point of X-rays, it gets difficult to collect light because there's so little of it, and our present detectors can only do so much. If you get to even more energetic stuff, it becomes even more rarer, and actually we somehow have to abandon light. We have to look at indirect ways of looking at things in light. So I would say no, not really. It just depends on the science case you're interested in. For example, X-rays usually come from things that are very hot, very energetic. The most explosive things in the universe produce X-rays. On the other hand, radio waves come from very specific things. For example, things that have very strong magnetic field lines, these produce a very specific type of radio wave. And no, I would just say it's the limits of our detector. I wouldn't say they're really important or not important ones.
I want to ask is, has there been a lot of effort into SETI beyond radio that you're aware of? Because like all the big SETI efforts, like the ones on screen right now, they all seem to be like in the radio wavelength range. But if I think of like how aliens might try to communicate, they might try to use a completely different wavelength range. Maybe they figured out that it's much easier to have like a really big X-ray laser pointed at another star system.
I was just gonna say that. Yeah.
And do you know how much effort there's been into like other things?
Honestly,
if I think of like the radio wavelengths, they're really big compared to other wavelengths you could use.
Yeah. Radio was started just because it's the technology we had in the 50s. It's everywhere, right? It's just you have a radio antenna now pointed at space. There's no other reason for really using radio. And I know there have been some efforts to track and also send out laser pulses, but I don't know much about it and how successful it has been. Well, it's not been successful. I think we would hear about it otherwise, but no. Yeah.
Last question.
One comment to radio versus laser thing. I think one advantage is if you have... radio transmission is transmitting in all directions at the same time. Typically, if you have a laser or any directed thing, you must be, it's like a lighthouse, you must be in the beam, and that beam from the aliens or our beam must directly point to the receiver. So it's very unlikely that we are getting hit directly by the lighthouse beam from the aliens, or the aliens will see us if you're only using a laser pointer like that. So for trying to figure out anything, it's really nice having something distributing in all directions. Problem is that then the energy goes low. But other than that, there are physical effects like rotating stars and things those jets, what you have seen, we can't see them as gamma bursts and things like that. These are pointing directly to us, and if they're going aside of the Earth, we don't see it except for that in some gas atmosphere things. This is always what's possible to be detected at all, and how good our detectors are.
I'm sorry, was that, are you asking me, or you?
No,
it's just a comment you felt. Okay, no, it's true, radio waves, because they're lower wavelength, they get scattered more, meaning they bend a lot. So there's the idea that if you send out one there, it probably gets deflected in all kinds of directions, and one might hit an alien. But one could make the argument you could also point a laser randomly in every direction and you'd get the same effect. I don't know. I honestly think it was just the technology that was around at the time, more than anything. But yeah, that is true. That is an effect.
X-ray lasers is a very interesting physical experiment.
Yes, but you need to put it in space because the atmosphere blocks X-rays.
Even that's difficult.
I mean, even that's
okay. But one moment. I think the I think the discussions could continue after that talk, so thank you very much for all the questions.